This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Well, according to one history professor, if you move to Western North Carolina and you haven't read Wilma Dykeman's first book, you ought to have your driver's license revoked. The book is called The French Broad. It's a history of the river that runs through downtown Asheville and was published in 1955. The book established Wilma Dykeman as a pioneer in environmental conservation. She went on to publish 17 more books in her lifetime. She wrote about issues including race, birth control, and chemically altered food long before they were hot topics. Wilma Dykeman died in 2006, but her publishing career is still going. After her death, her son discovered a typewritten manuscript in her house. It's a memoir of her formative years growing up in the Beaver Dam Valley. It's called Family of Earth, A Southern Mountain Childhood, and it's coming out soon from UNC Press. Joining me to tell us more about his mother's latest book and her legacy is Wilma Dykeman's son, Jim Stokely, and he joins us from partner station WCQS in Asheville. Hello, Jim.
Hey, good to be here.
Good to have you. And also in the studio in Asheville is Karen Craig-Nolan. She's the executive director of Riverlink, a nonprofit that works to preserve and protect the French Broad River in Asheville. Karen, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
Jim, let me start with you. Tell us about the discovery of this book and what it meant to you.
Well, in terms of the discovery, Wilma and her husband, my father, never threw anything away. They saved every letter, every book, every scrap of material. So you can imagine what their house looked like. So one day, a couple of years ago, I'm looking through a couple of large wooden cabinets, built-in wooden cabinets full of just stuff. And at the very back corner of one of those cabinets, I found a white shirt box. You know, we've all, or at least used to know what these shirt boxes looked like from the department store. And it was labeled Northwestern Materials. She had graduated from Northwestern University near Chicago. And two rubber bands supposedly were holding it together. Well, these rubber bands couldn't hold anything together. They were calcified. they came in segments. You got the feeling that you know, if I scratched one of them, I'd come down with some terrible disease. And inside there was on top a commencement program and, you know, some college papers. But at the very bottom, there was a half-inch thick sheaf of double-sided typewritten pages, and that was Family of Earth.
There was this manuscript written when she was, turns out, 23 years old. Now, ordinarily, you know, say a son finding his mom's manuscript from a long time ago, that might be interesting to the family. But this is the manuscript of a woman who was a successful author who had published 18 books. And so the fact of this thing as an unpublished manuscript must have been pretty surprising to you.
It was unbelievable in two ways, really. I saw it and I said, could this be? And she had, in her later years, had told a lot of people, including writers' conferences, et cetera, that she was going to write her autobiography. Well, you know, we all know what a lot of people who want to do that, it just never happens. But here I am. It dawns on me after about 30 seconds that this is a memoir of her very early years. So that was the first wonderful result. But there was a second result. After about 2 minutes, I was thumbing through this, and I said, this is really well written. This is one of the best things she ever wrote. So I hate to use a movie reference, but my reaction was absolutely identical to Jeff Goldblum's reaction in the original Jurassic Park. When they're in Jeeps and they're seeing the first live dinosaur that this park fellow has created, Jeff Goldblum, he's just smiling. He's just he's almost laughing, and he says, he did it.
Well, I was going to say the other wonderful thing about the book is now she's 23 years old, so autobiography at that tender age, you know, it's a memoir of this early formative time, and it is intimately tied up with her love of nature and her instinct toward conservation. That's also an important part of the book, is it not, Jim?
It is. It is. Kirkus Reviews gave it a starred review and really keyed on the nature part. I mean, she just got some unbelievably lyrical passages in there about various aspects of nature, from plants and animals to forest fires. She was an only child at the head of the Beaver Dam Valley, and on 10 or 11 acres there, her friends were the plants and animals of the forest. So that's really where she came to environmental consciousness.
Maybe you could read for us from page one to give us a sense of exactly what this book is about.
All righty. You can tell on page one that she's a little bit afraid that people might look askance at her being 23 and writing a memoir. She says, perhaps some will believe that this book is of no contemporary moment, that it does not deal directly with the situation which is at hand. But the earth is with us always, and we are one family upon it. It is peace upon this earth for which we fight. Good peace. It is life upon this earth for which we die. Full life. It is what our peace and life have meant to us in yesterday that will enable us to fight and die today. Perhaps, too, I can hope that this book will mean more than yesterday or today, something also of tomorrow. And if to any, it appears presumptuous to write a book about one's life, especially when that life has been so unimportant, then all I can answer is this. First, it is the only life I know intimately enough to write about and say what I would say. And second, every life, no matter how inconsequential in the tide of nationalities, has overtones of the universal and themes which are common to all men and all nature.
Jim Stokely reading from his mother's memoir, Family of Earth, the book that comes out next week. So, Jim, obviously she didn't talk about this, or you would not have had the Jurassic Park reaction when you found it. But was there any hint about the fact that she had written this? And if not, do you know why perhaps it wasn't published? Did she try to get it published?
I think she lost it. She tried to get a lot of stuff published. You know, people think writers just go from one success to another, but writers, they go, as the old tobacco commercial used to say, over, under, around, and through. I mean, they go up forward a step and back two steps and have failures and successes. And, you know, she wrote this, and I'm sure she probably made an effort to get it published, but it just had no chance with New York publishers, you know, a 20-something unknown from the southern mountains. So it just went into a box, and I really think it just got lost. Wilma's was a fighter all her life, and when something bad happened, she just marked it down and said, I'm going to move on.
Wow.
And she just moved on from this.
She moved on for many years, and I'm also with Karen Cragnolan, who's the executive director of Riverlink. Karen, you met Wilma when she was in her 70s. What was she like then?
Fiery, independent, funny, irreverent, marvelous, and totally with it. I remember she would call me, and she would quiz me on different topics, like, what do you think of charter schools? I'd say, gosh, Mama, you know, I don't really have a big opinion. Well, get back to me. She was just an incredible woman, and I felt so honored to have forged a bond with her. Lucky.
If it's true that nobody in North Carolina should have a driver's license if they haven't read her work, Karen, would you say that this early memoir is a good introduction to the body of her work?
Well, I do think that. And, you know, she wrote about universal themes. And I think from the very beginning, she was concerned about legacy and diversity and linkage and lineage and, you know, those universal themes that she continued to write about. One of the things that as she matured and her writing, you know, got in the French Broad, she really made the very first articulation of an argument about why clean water is an economic development strategy. And, you know, to this day, I don't know anybody has said it more succinctly or better, that, you know, if you keep your water clean, you'll have a quality of life that will make people want to visit and will make people want to bring their companies here and live here. And my goodness, if we don't look around today and see New Belgium, Sierra Nevada, Oscar Blues, all of the companies, GE that's, you know, making these ceramic engines. I mean, it's, what is it about? It is about the quality of life, and it's about clean water, and we have one of the largest watersheds in the whole country right here, and it's, you know, it's clean, it's pristine. So water is a huge attraction, and she understood that, and she understood this 7 years before Rachel Carson wrote The Silent Spring. I mean, this woman was writing about topics that we're still discussing.
Right. Well, it's interesting too, Jim. Maybe I'll put this question to you, although you can both both chime in. The idea, as you said, Karen, the maybe one of the first to make the argument that environmental concerns are an economic interest. They are definitely something that that can be commodified. This from a woman who talked about the oneness and the interconnectedness, something that right. we take to be an ethical and deep spiritual value, somehow managed to see both of these as entwined and not at all separate. Again, kind of revolutionary for, you know, the 1950s.
Right. And go ahead.
No, go ahead, Jim.
Well, she her parents introduced her to the water cycle in the mid-20s. Today, the water cycle is everywhere. But back then, they would take her down to the Beaver Dam Creek and draw her attention to water going over a flat rock under the bridge. And so you see that water. And then they would describe all the rivers and tributaries that would take that water via the French Broad and the Tennessee River and the Ohio and the Mississippi to the Gulf Coast. And the other parent would chime in and sort of finish out the cycle and say, but it doesn't end there, Wilma. She's 6, 7 years old, and describe how evaporation and the clouds coming back over would close the loop. And they would finish that. They'd say, we need to be back here in 3 weeks, Wilma, because some of this same water will come over this same rock. Mm. So you can imagine the effect that had. And that was one of her core principles, that everything is connected. Mm-hmm. You can't compartmentalize things and separate them out.
Is that something she taught? I mean, did you have the same kind of upbringing, or did she keep her professional life kind of separate from her family life?
No. She included us. She included her mother, her elderly mother, on her talk. She was a world-class speaker, gave 50 talks a year, and people in she spent about half her life in East Tennessee, about half her life in Western North Carolina. People in Tennessee wanted her to run for Senate, and she said, "Well, don't you want to know my politics? Don't you want to know whether I'm, you know, Republican or Democrat?" They said, "Wilma, we just want to hear you talk."
she was Tennessee state historian, and you know, she was well loved there as well as here.
Right,
taught at the university and wrote a weekly column for the newspapers. I mean, She has a woman of huge influence. I remember when we were trying to do the American Heritage River Initiative, she called Al Gore from my office. I was so impressed.
He took the call, did he?
He did. Hi, this is Wilma Dykeman. Oh, yeah. Just put him right through.
Wait, yeah, she, go ahead, Jim.
She babysat for young Al Gore at one time. Her career hit a little bit of a cropper 2 years after the French Broad in North Carolina. She and my dad published a book called Neither Black Nor White about the race question in the South 3 years after Brown versus Board of Education. And they kind of interviewed hundreds of people across the South from Houston to Charleston, including Medgar Evers and others, and really put a stake in the ground that early in the civil rights struggle in favor of integration. And country singer Barbara Mandrell, great country singer, used to have a song, "I Was Country When Country Wasn't Cool." Well, they were integrationists when integration wasn't cool. And at that time, they really considered North Carolina their base of operations. But, you know, the two senators at the time were Sam Ervin and Mr. Scott. And Sam Ervin had actually drafted the Southern Manifesto that every senator in the South signed, except the two from Tennessee and the two from Texas, including Lyndon Johnson. And that kind of oriented them more toward just across the state line in East Tennessee.
And that Tennessee senator was Albert Gore Sr., I assume, at the time, right?
Albert Gore Sr. Yeah. And Estes Kefauver. And Mother really admired Albert Gore Sr.'s wife, Pauline Gore. I just thought, and I had the chance to meet both of them and talk with Pauline. And you talk about a political genius. She was a great asset to the Gore family.
Well, she shines a light on so much of the political and even literary complexity here in the state of North Carolina. You talk about Sam Ervin, who was a hardcore segregationist, the leader of the segregationist movement, also the hero of Watergate. So there's that complexity. The idea that her politics didn't interfere much when it came to environmental concerns, but on the issue of race in the 1950s, a very important question, not only in the legislature, but also in the publishing world. Lewis Rubin, who is an icon and a hero, founder of Algonquin Books, one of the great, and you talk to writers today who are deeply influenced by him, a son of the South. Am I right, Jim?
Right. Yeah. He was. He grew up Jewish in Charleston. A fellow with immense talents. Brought young writers along when he taught at Hollins and later at UNC. But he. But at this time and back in '57, you know, he had just come off a stint as assistant editor working with James Kilpatrick at Richmond News Dispatch in Virginia. And of course, James Kilpatrick was one of the staunchest segregationists of the segregationists. So, even though Lewis Rubin was never as conservative as that, he even in his New York Times obituary, they noted that he regretted that he didn't sort of see the light on race relations until a bit later.
I wonder if I can ask you to read again, Jim. Your mother, I know, thought about the connection between humans and nature, and it's evident in that early writing, as we say. There's a passage about growing up in Beaver Dam Valley. Maybe you can read that for us, I think, on page 8.
Yes, be happy to. This was the way of the valley when I was a child. It was a memorable thing in winter to drive along the road and see the early fog settling down over the coves at 5 o'clock of an afternoon. Slowly, silently, with the drifting measuredness of time, it surrounded the trees, flowed down the hills, and shifted from sight the contours of the land. We could watch it moving toward the hill behind our house and knew that when we reached home we would be in the midst of a cloud, a wet, moving grayness that would make the edges of the world seem limitless and ourselves set far apart in an uninhabited solitude. Or it was memorable of a summer evening to watch the blending of colors scattered by the sun. Rich as a fabulous carpet is rich, the shadows lay soft and deep over the hillsides, rising and falling in a blend of purple and blue and green. There was a sense of luxury and mellowness in the mountains then. The people, too, were intricate and varied, with all the intricacy and variety so unsuspected and so characteristic of simple people. They worked and played and hunted, bore children, died and dug in patches of rocky ground. Each was memorable in his own separate way.
Jim Stokely, reading from his mother's memoir, Family of Earth, his mother Wilma Dykeman. He is here along with Karen Cragnolan, who's executive director of Riverlink. And Karen, I wonder if you have some thoughts on Wilma Dykeman's legacy in that area today and in the entire state.
Well, I think that her legacy is universal, and I don't think of her as just a Western North Carolina writer or East Tennessee writer. I think of her as a world writer who really understood the interconnectedness of things. And right here in Western North Carolina, Jim and I are working real hard to get her legacy commemorated with a new parkway that would follow the French Broad River. And we did a master plan, and we're calling it the Wilma Dykeman Riverway. And it has already attracted $200 million in state and federal highway funds. And we're very excited about it. And it is a great example of how you have economic opportunity and environmental protection for this wonderful third oldest river in the world resource that she wrote so beautifully about.
As you say, her thoughts are universal and her style is universally readable. But how well known is she in Western North Carolina?
Well, we think that everybody, you know, should know Wilma Dykeman. Jim, you want to say?
Well, when Ann and I, my wife Ann and I, retired back here after 30 years in the corporate world, we actually thought one of the negatives was we would just be hearing Wilma Dykeman this, Wilma Dykeman that. And we got down here and it was the reverse. People of Wilma's age, she was born in 1920, are kind of passing away. And the transplants, the great immigrants to North Carolina, really don't know about her because even though she should be internationally known with her skills and talents, she was regionally known. We just looked at each other and we said, this is not right. So we formed a little nonprofit called the Wilma Dykeman Legacy that's dedicated to sustaining her three core values.
Well, that sounds great. And you and Karen Cragnolan and others will do a lot to restore her memory and bring her the attention she deserves. Jim Stokely, president of the nonprofit Wilma Dykeman Legacy, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Karen Cragnolan is executive director of the nonprofit Riverlink in Asheville. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Wilma Dykeman's book, Family of Earth, The Southern Mountain Childhood, comes out next week. You can find out details at our website, stateofthings.org. Stay tuned to The State of Things.